Hey, it's Lena.
And I'm Aman.
And this is Grounded Geeks,
where we make the geek world relevant. So in a couple days is the 20th anniversary of 9/11. So this week we decided to do something a little different, you know?
Yep.
You and I, we were both around when 9/11 happened. We're both Muslim Americans. So we thought it might be nice to share some of our experiences and everything of the last 20 years.
Yeah. Nice may not be the best word.
Well, I thought maybe something that our audience can appreciate. A perspective.
Yeah. I don't even know if appreciator is right. Everything about 9/11 is really just shitty. So, but yeah, we just wanted to acknowledge it. Obviously, we've talked previously before about how we are Muslim Americans. And
yeah. It obviously shapes a lot of our identity. It shapes a lot of our interests. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that 9/11 probably affected us in a way that was more fundamental than many of our friends and colleagues, I think.
Yeah. And I think,
or am I being too presumptuous in that assumption?
No, I agree with that. I also think it affected us in ways, at least for me, that I'm still processing and or have not processed, probably.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to that. Still processing in a weird way, because things seem to still be affected by the Twin Towers falling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And changing every year, it seems.
Yeah.
That requires a reprocessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Aman and I came up with a brief list of questions that we basically were just going to ask each other about 9/11. So yeah.
It's going to be a very circular interview.
Yeah, it is. We're just going to interview each other, basically. So, yeah. Well, 9/11, purely shit day, obviously.
Yes, it was.
For many, many reasons. Yeah. So, Aman, what do you remember about that day?
When the first Twin Towers fell, I was actually on a school bus going from our high school to our sister high school, because I was taking an engineering drafting class.
You took an engineering drafting class? What?
Yeah, it was awesome. It's like architecture, but with like mechanical parts.
Oh, I didn't even know you did that. Wait, you were in 10th grade, 11th grade? What grade were you in again?
10th.
You were in 10th grade, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was in 7th grade.
Yep. So the reason I know for a fact that it was on the bus is because it happened while I was on the bus, is because as soon as I got to the classroom, the TV was on, and that was when I found out what had just happened.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I think it was just like, it felt like a movie. Like, I think in that moment, you know, and being in a 10th grader, I was processing it the same way I would have had I seen it in a movie. And at the time, I was like super into Tom Clancy novels. So immediately that one book that he wrote, not Executive Orders, but the Executive Orders was the name of the sequel, but I forget the name that was right before. But that was the book where he had written about a terrorist attack where a plane had flown into the U.S. Capitol.
Oh my gosh. He wrote that like before 9/11, obviously.
Oh yeah. Wow, yeah. Weird. Before 9/11. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I was just like processing it the same way I would have, was I watching a movie, like, oh, wow. Like what, like, you know, not really understanding the full impact of what it meant, but that's what I was doing. And that's where I was when 9/11 happened. Where were you, Lena?
I was in our middle school in Michigan. Uh-huh. We were both in Michigan at the time. And yeah. I remember a bunch of us, we were waiting outside our social studies class. We were, the class was going over a bit, and we were just, you know, the bell had rang. We were waiting for everyone to come out of that classroom.
Right.
And when they came out, all these, you know, we were 12 years old. So like all these kids were just kind of screaming like, we're under attack, you know, like, and everyone just sounds like a lunatic. And I was like, okay, yeah. Is this some weird like prank everyone's playing? Like, I don't get what's happening, right. You know? And I walk in, the TV's already on, and everyone is just sort of like, oh my gosh, oh my God, you know, like talking to each other, like, what's going on? What's this? What's that? And my social studies teacher, I don't particularly remember him even really acknowledging us. He was just, his eyes were glued to the screen. He couldn't stop watching. And then we saw the second plane hit live. Like,
wow.
We saw that happen live, which I was like, probably shouldn't have happened. You know, like we probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
So I remember that very well. I have very vague memories of like, maybe like they ushered us all into the same classroom. And I think we were sitting on the floor, you know, similar to like those tornado drills we did, or the fire drills or something. And
interesting.
Not a fire drill, because then we would have gone
outside. Like the tornado drills.
I have like a very vague memory of that, but I honestly don't remember how the rest of my school day went. I remember because everyone was just like, oh my God, what's happening? Oh my, like, you just like, ooh, like this is crazy, you know? It also kind of, I think it just felt like a movie to us. It didn't feel real. And I remember coming home, and I came home later than you because you were in high school. And I remember you and our mom sitting on the couch in the study, and the TV was on. And I remember seeing both of your faces, and that's when the seriousness of it really hit me. I was like, oh shit, like this is really, really bad. Like, and that's when my little 12-year-old brain was starting to understand, oh God, this is really bad.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, obviously, I must have come home, and whatever after school thing I was doing must have gotten canceled. But yeah, a lot like you, other than that incident of that specific of when it happened, outside of that, I also don't really remember how the rest of the day played out beyond just vague memories of nothing happening and every TV in the school being on and every classroom on CNN.
Yeah, I don't. Do you remember if we got sent home early? I don't think we did. Because literally every other person I've talked to, like all my other friends who did not grow up in Michigan or wherever, you know, like I've heard from almost all of them that they were released early and everyone went home early that day. And I don't know why we didn't, but
I do have
another memory of later that day. I think it was in my Spanish class. Again, we were just being shuffled from classroom to classroom, and all the TVs were on. And I remember in my Spanish, I think it was my Spanish class, and there's one, sorry to laugh, but this one girl was crying because she thought the next terrorist target might be the Renaissance Festival in Michigan. And I, like, even then I was like, girl, please stop. Like, this is not going to happen. And our Spanish teacher was like, oh, sweetheart, that will literally never happen.
Yeah. There was a lot of hysteria around, oh my God, what's going to be the next target? If the definition of terrorism is somebody committing an act of violence to further a political agenda, but committing an act of violence specifically to instill fear in a populace to further their agenda. The World Trade Centers were a symbol of commerce.
And you capitalism.
Know? And of commerce and capitalism. Like, it was more than just New York City. New York City is obviously an economic hub, has been for a very long time. But the Twin Towers were a symbol of that economic hub that just, it meant something, you know, it meant something to attack it. And I remember when Congress started to issue funding for, you know, terrorism prevention, you know, law enforcement funding, things like that. I remember seeing this one study being like, Wyoming has gotten more money per capita for these efforts than New York City. And I was like, wait, what is happening in Wyoming that I am completely unaware of?
Yeah.
Like, it just seemed like it. I think that was 9/11 for me. It prompted a lot of realization of how our society can act stupidly,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the face of something that we can't even wrap our minds around.
Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts on that. I'll get to that at some point.
Yeah. But the next question I wanted to ask, Lena, is I figured we'd skip to question three. In mm-hmm. the immediate aftermath, in like the coming months afterwards, did you experience any Islamophobia against yourself as a person?
You know, I don't think I experienced any blatant Islamophobia.
Mm-hmm.
Although a lot of times now, when I think about certain interactions and certain experiences,
mm-hmm.
I, as like in a semi-adult, I now understand them differently. And mm. I'm realizing that they probably weren't so nice as, or like, I was probably giving people the benefit of the doubt when I shouldn't have been in some instances.
Gotcha.
But I mean, I'm mainly like, I'm sure similar to you. I just felt like all of a sudden I had to be this poster child customer service representative for Islam and all Muslims.
Yeah.
So I had like kids coming up to me asking me questions about Ramadan and fasting and all, you know, like all kinds of stuff, which is mm-hmm. like, which is fine. But I, for many, many years after 9/11, I took it on myself to really represent everything and try to answer people. I wanted to change people's hearts and minds, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. it was so exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, it's just left me feeling pretty bitter and numb, especially when I read the news now of what's happening in right. Afghanistan and everything. And it all just feels like, what was it for? What did I do that for besides just to kind of exhaust myself and drain myself? And mm-hmm. I'm sure, obviously, the people I became friends with as I was growing up, you know, I'm guessing this was the same for you, but for me, like, you know, we were in Michigan and then you went to college in Michigan and I moved mm-hmm. to Cincinnati, Ohio. And the whole time we were in the Midwest, especially, I was a lot of people's only brown friend, only Muslim yes. friend and whatever. And yes. I know, I'm sure I had some sort of impact on those friends or those people.
Right.
Who had personal interactions with me and got to know me a bit. But mm-hmm. beyond that, I don't know. I don't really know or think I made much of a difference. What about you?
Yeah. That's interesting. So I didn't experience any direct Islamophobia. Actually, I remember like maybe a week after 9/11 happened, it's like small group of like older jock kids who I didn't even know. So just a bit of context here. We, for everybody, the area that we lived in was already very diverse, and it had a very large Arab population. So there yeah. were more Muslims per capita in our school district than in most other parts of the country. So we yeah. definitely had that benefit. But, you know, at the same time, I felt like a lot of my classmates understood that Islamophobia was a thing that could happen. And actually the small group of like, well, I think like upperclassmen, you know, they like came up to me and they were like, hey, Iman, anybody messes with you, you tell us. All right.
Were
like,
these we other, got your
back.
Were these like Arab kids, white kids? Who
no,
came up to
no.
Or, oh, they were white. Like what were they?
Yeah.
Okay.
yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so I was just like, and for a moment I was like, sure, thanks. But like, I didn't understand why they yeah. were doing that because I had experienced so little racism, Islamophobia in my life up to that point. You know, having yeah. grown up overseas, I was, you know, for you and I both, I always felt very comfortable being a minority because that was, in a sense, the only thing I knew. I only knew how to operate as a minority in any circumstance. Even when we were living in Pakistan, going to the American school over there, you know, when we were out and about in the public, it was like, oh, these are the kids that go to the American school. When we were at the American school, we were, obviously there were a lot of other Muslims there, but we still fit this very, very unique spot, you know, where we were Americans, but we were still Pakistani Muslims, but also at the same time, we had strong connections to the US. We had family that lived here. We came back here every year, even when we were living in Pakistan.
We were also
born there, born there. And amongst the other Americans at our school, we were probably the only ones whose parents were not diplomats. So I always felt like even then we occupied this very, very niche spot that nobody else did, you know? Yeah. So I always felt very comfortable being a minority. So when I had that interaction at that school, I never really understood why, like, what is the problem that you're seeing that I'm not? In terms of, you know, just sort of sharing my experience, a reflection, I guess, a mirror of what you were talking about needing to be a representative of Islam and Muslims. Mm-hmm. So in that same way, one of the things I think that 9/11 did to me was that it made me learn a lot more about our own faith and our own religion and the history of Islamic civilization. And it made me understood very quickly that anytime somebody asked me questions, I had to be careful and accurate with how I replied.
Yes.
However, thinking about it now, I did not do that because I wanted to be a representative of Muslims or American Muslims, or even trying to be a representative for American Muslims. I very much did this as an act of self-defense.
Yeah.
You know, I did understand that if I answer these questions correctly and am able to put people at ease while still not running away from my religious identity, that is something that would make it easier for me to move around, operate in the world that I lived in.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I took it on as a burden in the same way that you did, even though our actions were exactly the same, only because I purely viewed it as an act of self-defense, you know?
Yeah, interesting.
Make sure you can talk your way out of any situation even before it turns into a situation.
So that's very interesting. I feel like I also was doing it out of some self-defense. I also started reading more and learning more about our religion and about Islam and all that, and being Muslim, because I always wanted to be ready, like whether it was in a debate in class or some random person coming up to me on the street, you know, like I wanted to be ready with the right answer and with all the correct evidence and whatever. But I totally just took it on. I joined the board of our Muslim student association in college, and I remember planning events like, do you have questions about Islamophobia, come ask us, and it's like, oh god, I just like hated it. I mean, I hate it now when I think about it. Back then I had so much energy and I thought, you know, it was making a difference, and I don't know, I feel very jaded about it now.
I think you still shouldn't discredit the impact that you probably had on those around you. You know, I mean, we didn't change policy. Islamophobia is still a billion-dollar business every year.
Yeah.
But you know, at least in the people that we interacted with, I think we made a positive impact. You know.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I never saw evidence of it firsthand, really. Outside of my own personal circles. But yeah. Well, okay. Next question. Did 9/11 change how you thought about your identity? And if so, how?
I don't know if it changed how I thought about my identity, but it definitely made me need to understand my identity more. I think it accelerated a process that probably wouldn't have happened for another 5 to 10 years later. Because when you're a teenager, are you really wanting to think about who am I? What does it mean for me to be me? You know, I mean, these, and obviously when I went through that processing a lot sooner than I may would have otherwise. And I think it made me, I think it also shaped how I went through that journey, because it was always in the context of there are people who hate Muslims because of 9/11. And that's on top of the fact that I think they hated us beforehand.
Yeah.
So it definitely, I think, shaped that journey in a big way. It definitely made me interested, not just in learning about more about Islam. I mean, I don't know about you, but the first thing I think I looked up was, what the hell is jihad? Like,
yeah.
I don't know what that means. Like, no, I've heard the word thrown around, but if somebody asks me, what does it mean? I don't really know how to answer that. Because I'm 15.
All these news anchors were like, they want to wage jihad on us. And we were like, what is that? Like, we don't even know. Yeah, I was like, what? Okay, I have no idea what that is.
we had to read up for as whether it was for altruistic reasons of, you know, trying to be representatives of our community or just self-defense. I was like, I got to learn this. I got to know what it means. Like, I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
Not really. So it prompted that sort of education for me. It also made me interested in learning more about other religions.
I remember you would go to like Bible study and stuff, right? Or something.
Because I was curious. I was like, I can't understand my own religion unless I understand others, you know? I think people are genuinely shocked that I have read the Bible cover to cover, you know, and taken actual classes on it, you know, in college. And I've read the Tanakh cover to cover, you know, these are things that I have done and I have learned a lot from.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty cool that our parents like were fine with you going to Bible study. They were like, we don't understand it, but sure, like go have fun, learn something.
Yeah, I mean, it prompted curiosity in me. I was purely curious.
Yeah.
And it also made me realize that across the board, regardless of what religion you're a part of, there are people who will interpret the religion that in a way that does not make sense, or contorts things in a way that is not the original intent of whatever scripture it is that you're reading. Like it made me hone my elevator speech.
Yeah.
You know, learning about how that happens, learning about the ways in which it happens, it really helped me hone my elevator speech on Islam or really any aspect of Islam.
Yeah.
So
it's funny. I mean, speaking of other religions and all that, but just a few months ago, I was talking with someone about, she was telling me how she grew up in a very rural part of America. And, you know, with this whole pandemic, everything that's going on, there's a lot of people in her town who refuse to get vaccinated. They don't want to have mask mandates, all this stuff, blah, blah, blah. And she said something like, it is so embarrassing what this town, these people who claim to be, you know, they're like the same, we come from the same faith background, all this stuff. And like, they are just totally misinterpreting the faith, our faith and whatever, to back up these ridiculous notions of not wanting to vaccinate against this pandemic, blah, blah, all this stuff. Yeah. And I was just, I mean, and she was really like, she was obviously very upset and she was kind of like venting to me about it. And I just kind of, I just like looked at her and I was like, I know exactly how that feels. You know, I know what it feels like when a group of people who look like you, who come from the same faith background as you, completely distort your faith to the public, you know?
Yeah.
And so,
Did a light bulb go off in this person's head?
A little bit. Yes. I don't know. So, but she was like, I know, kind of, you know, and anyway. But
kind of reminds me of this scene from the show Resident Alien that Sci-Fi did, really fantastic show. But
I never saw it. No.
Oh, it's absolutely hilarious and fantastic and serious at the same time. No. But the main character is an alien who crash lands on Earth, and it then is basically trying to survive and pose as a human. And he ends up making a friend. She is Native American, and they end up going to an alien convention because they're trying to track down something. And he gets there and he looks around and he's like, do these people think my people are a costume? My people are not a costume. And his friend just looks over, pats him on the shoulder, and just goes, welcome to my world.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. Like, it had that moment of, it triggered for me something that I had understood intellectually. It made me understand it at a gut level.
Yeah.
You know, everything that's been happening with the name of the Washington football team and everything, like, yeah, I understood intellectually why it's wrong, but I needed that moment to understand in my gut,
yeah,
why all of it was wrong.
Yeah.
And that emotional intellectual connection can be so important sometimes.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
and requires something random to trigger it.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Going back to that question. So did 9/11 change how you thought about your identity? For
yeah,
me, I think I just became super hyper aware of the fact that I'm Muslim. And
got it.
Rather than actually thinking about how I see myself, how I identify myself, I think I started becoming very paranoid and obsessed with how the world sees me, with, yes, how other people see me, the assumptions that they make about me. Mm-hmm. And this is as I don't even wear the hijab, you know, I don't wear the headscarf, yeah, or anything. And it's like, and I still felt that I can't even imagine a Muslim woman who wears a headscarf, like how she had felt in the past 20 years since 9/11, walking into rooms and the assumptions people made about her and continue to make about her. But, you know, you were saying in Michigan, when we were growing up, the school district that we were in, there were actually a lot of Muslims and Jews in our school district.
Yeah. So yeah,
it's kind of like amazing that way. But actually in our middle school, I don't know, mm-hmm, if this was the case for you, but at least in my year, like my classmates and stuff, there weren't, mm-hmm, that many brown Arab kids. There were maybe like 4-5 of us in my year total. And the high school became more diverse because there were multiple middle schools feeding into like these two high schools.
You know, that's a good point. Right? I never thought about it, but you're so right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Our middle school was not as diverse as our high school.
And I remember my elementary school wasn't either. When we moved to Michigan, you were starting, mm-hmm, seventh grade, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
but you went through all of high school with that.
Yes.
Whereas I only got 1 year of that high school, which was an awesome year because I was a freshman and you were a senior. And that was like, right, one and only time when we were in the same school. But
yeah.
So I only got 1 year of that. And then, you know, you went to college in Michigan, mm-hmm, and then we moved to Cincinnati and it got,
right,
depressingly less diverse in Cincinnati, yeah, for me.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I felt even more paranoid, not just about being Muslim, but literally about my skin color. I got weirdly self-conscious about my skin color at times and in high school in Ohio. And yeah, and it's just like, and I was so obsessed with trying to go to a bigger city that had more diversity for college. That was like literally my only goal. I was like, please, I just want more friends, yeah, of color. Like, and not to discredit like the friends that I did make in high school, they were awesome. They were great, but it just felt like something was missing. And I always, yeah, had to be like explaining myself or kind of walking on eggshells a little bit, you know, mm-hmm, and thinking twice about what I said or did around them or in front of teachers and stuff. So yeah.
So for me, interestingly, I never had that specific desire because I didn't go through that high school experience that you did in, yeah, Ohio, but I never had that specific desire to seek out more friends of color because you remember what I was saying about always being very comfortable with being the minority, regardless of the setting.
Yeah.
It just didn't matter to me. even around other American Muslims, I still feel like a minority, yeah. like I don't belong. And that's because of the very, very unique upbringing that we had. Like for me, you know, living in America, for me, when people look at me, sometimes they don't know what to make of me because of how I walk and whatnot. But for the most part, they're like, okay, he looks like he's probably Muslim.
Yeah.
But you know, I really worked on how I speak in a very sort of enunciated way, you know, very news broadcaster-ish is yeah. what I went for. And at least in Michigan, it turned out really well. I'd open my mouth and people would find it very disarming, mm-hmm. you know, because all of a sudden look at somebody who they're like, you know, whatever they are thinking of me, and all those assumptions immediately go out the door as soon as I open my mouth. And interestingly, so when I was in college, I spent one summer in Shanghai doing an internship. Mm-hmm. And while I was over there, I asked one of the friends that I made, like, when you see me, what do you identify me as? Mm-hmm. And this guy was just like, Aman, everything about you, how you speak, how you walk, everything about you screams that you're an American. And yeah. I just thought that was very, very interesting because yeah. everything that I was displaying outside of myself with how I walk, how I talk, how I interact with people, outside of America, it screams American to yeah. everybody. But when I'm in America, fellow Americans don't see that. And it was, yeah. That was a very interesting
yes.
Moment and an interaction for me. So for me, trying to seek out people of the same background as me, I gave up on that so long ago because nobody has gone through exactly the kinds of experiences that we have. Even people who have lived abroad a lot, you know, our friends of ours whose parents were diplomats, for example, mm-hmm. you know, even they still had a very different experience from what we did
yeah.
Growing up. So I gave up on that a long time ago. So I just have a relatively small group of friends, and it really is for me just a one-to-one thing,
yeah. you know,
as to whether I get along with somebody or whether I'm friends with somebody or not. I never sought out a group of people because I'd given up hope.
Yeah, that's so fun. I mean, it's so true. Even when, you know, when we'd go to Pakistan every summer to visit family and stuff, mm. I remember whenever I was unfortunately dragged with our mom and aunt to go to like a market or whatever, you know,
yeah,
I would be speaking Urdu with them, but like the shopkeepers immediately could tell that I'm not like full on Pakistani, you know, they're like, oh,
right.
She's from America, Amrikiya, you know? And so, yeah. And so it always just felt like, well, everyone can tell I'm American in Pakistan, but like, I'm not American enough in America. And,
yeah.
And it just, but we also didn't feel like we properly fit in with the Pakistani Americans in America, because a lot of times, like, they didn't even speak Urdu at home, and
yeah.
we spoke way more Urdu than them, but it still wasn't yeah. like great enough Urdu to be appreciated in Pakistan, you know, like we were teased a lot for it. And so it just felt like such a weird middle ground a lot of times. And
I mean, in that same way, when I first moved to New York City, I had friends of mine tell me, Aman, you need to stop talking the way you talk. It's very disconcerting. Because I would still enunciate a lot more than I do now. And they were just like, dude, you got to stop.
You got to chill out.
Yeah, you got to chill out. I was like, this is yeah. just how I speak. So, like, you know, I think in that
mechanism, right? Like it became a defense mechanism for you.
In many ways it did, but I also took a lot of pride in it.
Yeah. You know,
that I could speak in a way that
yeah.
evoked a certain set of impressions and feelings on the person who was listening to me.
For me, I think it was humor. I tried very hard as a way to disarm people and make them more mm-hmm. comfortable around me. I would, in my head, I was like, okay, if I can just make them laugh, they'll feel much better.
Right.
And now I'm like, why the hell was I so concerned with their comfort? Like, who cares? Now I'm like, screw you. If you're not comfortable around me, then like, go talk to a therapist. Like, I don't know. You know,
well, to be fair, you know, for us, we have that risk where if somebody is not comfortable around us, we don't know if they might attack us.
I know. Yeah.
And you know, that is an actual thing that we have to think about whenever we're interacting with anyone.
Yeah. This kind of goes into the next question I was going to ask, which was, what did you feel on or right after 9/11 versus now 20 years later? Just a quick answer of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think right after 9/11, I felt a lot of fear. I felt like I needed to learn more about Islamic history and Islam and whatever to prepare myself. Like I felt the need to prepare myself for any and every situation, any and every conversation, uncomfortable conversation. And now I am just tired of being afraid. I am tired of holding other people's hands, making them feel comfortable. I am tired of being the representative. I'm like, read a fucking book, you know, like you have literally the entire knowledge of the world at the tip of your fingers on your phone, you know, like figure it out, you know, do some soul searching. And so that's one of the biggest things that I feel between then versus now. But what about you?
Then versus now, you know, I mean, I don't know if there's necessarily a stark change in terms of 9/11. The fact that we are only leaving Afghanistan now after 20 years of being there. I feel very jaded about our country's capacity to learn and understand major events. You know, I think that when 9/11 happened, I, you know, obviously went through all the things that I described, but I also felt like, you know what? I occupy a unique position here as an American Muslim who has seen a lot of the world, that I could make a difference here, you know, that I could do something to affect policy, to impact in a positive way how our country deals with this moment in terms of not just national security, but in terms of public policy and society. And now, you know, the thing that really strikes me is that one quote from Winston Churchill I learned a long time ago of, you can always count on America to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other option. And at this point, honestly, I'm just like, I guess we haven't gone through every other option yet, have we? You know? And I don't think I can accelerate that process in any way, shape, or form. So there's a big part of me that's now jaded with my own personal value to my country, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, what was it, like 2 weeks ago when you know, they first announced whatever, all the press conferences started happening of Afghanistan and whatever, first started evacuating people, all that stuff. And some like major army general came on this press conference. And then he mispronounced Kabul. When he did that, I was like, are you kidding me? It's been 20 years. You still don't know how to even pronounce Kabul? You guys haven't learned shit. Literally. That's the thing. It's like, I just keep asking myself, Aman, I'm just like, what was the point? What was the point of the past 20 years? What was the point? These people didn't even learn how to say the word Kabul. Okay. Literally, like when that happened, besides me just turning off the TV, I feel like I just got hit with this realization. Well, I mean, I knew this, but it's like, it really hit me at that moment of like, America's never cared. I don't think they've ever cared about Afghans. They've never cared about Muslims. Like they've just never cared to learn about people, quite frankly, who are not white. Maybe this is like totally blasphemous and horrible to say, because obviously not every American, hashtag whatever, but like, but like, that is how it feels. It feels like They've never cared.
I mean, for every criticism about the evacuation of Afghanistan, I keep thinking, like, this is the most people have cared about Afghanistan in the last 15 years.
Yes.
And what we're doing there in the last 15 years. So any criticism that is there is really just on us as a society, you know, for not taking an interest in doing things right over there. So unless you've actively been working on what's happening in Afghanistan in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, what we're saying right now is not directed towards any of the journalists and social workers, nonprofit workers, photographers, whoever, you know, who have actually been trying to tell the story of Afghans for the past 20 years. But I mean, yeah, all the people who are like, but the Afghan women, like, where the hell were you for the past 15, 20 years?
Yeah.
Like,
it's not about any actions of any individual. If I broke down talking to every single individual person about, like, you know, there's always a good reason for why they don't have an interest, or they have had an interest and have been doing something about it. Really, this comment is more about how we as a collective have not taken an interest. In the last 15 years. And that's why it's been such a clusterfuck for the last 15 years. I mean, this end result is just not at all shocking or surprising to me. Could it have been better? Yeah. Could it have been, you know, could the actual evacuation have been better planned as we were pulling out? Absolutely. But in general, the fact that we are pulling out without having accomplished anything of staying power, you know, it's just not surprising to me, just given how things have been unfolding in the last 15 years.
And I truly feel bad for veterans and members of the U.S. military. Like, I think they feel so like, what the hell was the point? Are you kidding? Like,
I mean, I can't remember what article it was in, but, you know, that there's a saying in the military that, like, America is not fighting in Afghanistan. The military is fighting in Afghanistan. America is not. And that is the crux of the problem.
I mean, people have lost their lives, their limbs, their emotional well-being.
Yeah. So
what? I mean, it's just sad.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's really,
it is. It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But I want to also now switch a little bit to a slightly different topic. Mm-hmm. We are grounded geeks after all.
Yes.
How do you think 9/11 has changed the geek world and geek media and geek storytelling and geekiness?
Well, there's definitely been a big change. I don't think it's big enough in the last 20 years. I remember, wasn't it fairly soon after 9/11? There was that stupid show. I think you watched it. It was called 24.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wasn't that all about like terrorists and shit?
Yeah. But then it turned out the real bad guys were the Russians.
Oh, great. Another horrific stereotype that has not died in the last like 70 years. But okay.
I do also credit that show with Barack Obama getting elected in 2008, by the way.
That's interesting. Maybe we should do another episode on that. But yeah. Well, my point is there was so much and still continues to be a lot of very stereotypical imagery of Muslims. And I'm totally going to link to this in the show notes, but in like a month or so ago, there's this organization called like the Pillars Foundation, Pillars Fund. And they like teamed up with Riz Ahmed, the very famous actor. And they did a huge report about the representation of Muslims in media. And it was dismal. It was very bad. It was awful. Like there's like hardly any representation. If there is like a Muslim on a screen, they don't have any speaking lines, you know. There's like, and the representation in animation of Muslims is even worse. So it's just but you know, at the same time, there have been a lot more efforts, I'd say. I can now think of some Muslim actors and actresses and stuff, but I can still only count them on one hand, you know?
Yes. At the same time, I think it's taken way too long in the last 20 years, but I feel like now finally, you know, it shows like We Are Lady Parts and Little Mosque on the Prairie Which was also a pretty funny show from a little while ago, but you know, we're starting to see more and more of that.
And neither of those shows, by the way, are American. I believe
Little also true.
Mosque on the Prairie is Canadian and Weird Lady Parts is British. So yeah.
Peacock did pick it up as a Peacock original.
But yeah, yes, but it was but it was developed and written by a person from the UK.
Same thing with that one show, Man Like Mobeen.
Yeah, that too.
Absolutely hilarious, by the way, if so anybody funny. Hasn't seen it. Oh, so good.
I have an episode on that too. That was great. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So I think there's been a lot more male Muslim representation in the US, quite frankly.
Yes. Agreed.
Like there's also the show Rami. That's American.
Yeah.
There's like Riz Ahmed, obviously. Well, he's British, but you know, he's been in American productions of things. And like, what was that movie with Kumail Nanjiani called? The Big Sick.
The Big Sick.
Yeah. Like there's been a lot actually more prominent movies and TV shows that show things from the Muslim male perspective than the female perspective.
That is
true. In the US. Yeah. So
that is true. That is true.
I don't know.
I think that 9/11 has had such a huge impact actually on the geek world and the kinds of stories and conflicts that exist. Think about the very first Iron Man movie.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true.
That when they updated, originally the Iron Man story took place in Vietnam, you know, so whenever that. And you know, he gets captured by the Viet Cong, I guess, which is where he builds his armor in a cave and then busts out. But Iron Man, Tony Stark being an arms dealer is such a central part of his origin story that anytime they update the story, it has to be in whatever the latest war context is.
Yeah,
because it's so core. He has to be an arms dealer. He has to be a war profiteer, you know? Yeah. So that happened. And I feel like I keep seeing more and more stories where the conflict is about subversive forces within a place that need to be dug out. I feel like Nick Fury's stock as a character has increased significantly, not just because of Samuel L. Jackson's portrayal of him in the MCU, but also in the comic books, you know, where he is the super spy trying to find out about the secret plot that is being handled. And it's not that he hasn't always been that character, but the plots, I don't know, maybe it's just my impression and maybe it's because I came into this world in the post 9/11 world that I don't have a good sense of being able to compare what stories were like beforehand. But I feel like a lot of the bad guys are doing terrorist-like things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as opposed to stealing or conquering, for example.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Doom as a bad guy isn't that big of a deal.
Right.
It seems like he doesn't have the most intriguing stories because he's not subversive. He's not trying to carry out a terrorist plot.
Yeah. To go back to Iron Man very quickly and just to let me rant a little bit, what always pissed me off about the first Iron Man movie, and I mean, I love all the Marvel movies, huge fan, obviously, but what really pissed me off about that is when he's in the cave and he's been kidnapped all by these terrorists and whatever, they're all speaking Urdu and they're in Afghanistan. And
no,
they're in Iraq or something. No, are they in
Afghanistan? No, they're in Afghanistan, and it actually made perfect sense. They explained it in the movie. What was the doctor's name? The Iranian doctor?
I don't remember. Was he supposed to be Iranian in the movie because he was also speaking Urdu?
Yes, and he said that. Well, this group is comprised of people who speak, like they speak all these different languages. And in the same way that if you go to Dubai, the most spoken language in Dubai is actually not Arabic, it's Urdu.
Yeah,
Or Hindi. Urdu/ Hindi. And it's because Urdu and Hindi, which at the lay level sound exactly the same, it works as a common language,
especially
if you have a diverse. So they explained it in a way where I was like, okay, I will accept that. I would just like to give a shout out though to Jeff Bridges, whose Urdu accent was spot on.
Was it? I don't know.
he definitely had to make an effort, but he pronounced everything perfectly.
Okay. Well, and
I was so impressed.
We clearly have very opposite reactions to this. I don't know. That always annoyed me. And I was like, well, why aren't they portraying more languages? It was literally all Urdu. And I just felt like it seemed lazy to me. And I think another reason why it pissed me off so much is because I don't remember how many years later the movie Lincoln came out. That was about Abraham Lincoln with Daniel Day-Lewis playing him.
Mm-hmm.
But I was reading some article about the making of that movie. And they talk about how the research they went into that movie, they were like, yeah, we tracked down some like horse carriage from that time period that's in a museum. And then we recorded the sound of the carriage door closing and opening so that it would be accurate when we had it in the movie. I was like, you do this for fucking carriage doors, but you don't do this for brown people or Muslims or really any people of color. Like they're like such minimal effort is put a lot of times. Now, I'm not just talking about Iron Man now, but I'm just talking about in general about movies or TV shows about people of color. Such minimal effort is put into researching their background, mm-hmm. their culture, their customs, all of it. But they'll do it for a fucking horse carriage, you know? Like, it's just so... and I think that's just what pisses me off so much. Anyway.
I do have to give credit to Iron Man, the original Iron Man movie, though, for still doing a better job than others at that time.
Yeah, fine. It was better. And at least they had one sympathetic Muslim guy who still dies. But like, yeah, I don't know. It's just really... But a lot of the portrayal has just been like... I mean, like I'm thinking now of the TV show Homeland. I've watched random episodes here and there. I never really got into it. Mostly because I remember this is while I was living in New York, but one of the main posters to advertise one of the seasons of Homeland was, it showed like all these women in burqas. And then it showed what's her face, main actress,
Claire Danes
in like a red scarf and her like a little bit of her blonde hair, like peeking out. And she's looking back in a sea of women wearing burqas. And I was like, this is how they always want to see themselves. They always, it's like, yeah, you know what? We're going to tell the story of Muslim women in these exotic countries. But the main character is always going to be some white blonde woman. You know, it's always going to be some white people. It's always never actually going to be about the people, never actually going to center them in these stories. And so that's how it still feels like to me now.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of storytelling and
I get it. Do you remember the original Spider-Man movie
with Tobey Maguire? Yes,
that obviously came out in 2002.
Yes,
and I remember that there was at least something in the rumor mill about how the movie was originally going to have a scene where Spider-Man casts a web between the Twin Towers.
Oh, I remember.
And catches a helicopter in it. And they had to cut that, not just from the movie, but even from the trailer before the trailer came, because the trailer was supposed to come out pretty soon after 9/11.
Right.
And I think that in a lot of little ways, movies, comic books, they had to think about, like, do we tell a story that is relevant to this time? And at what point are we crossing that line of relevant into being offensive and you know, disrespectful to the people who lost their lives, to the people who then went off to war because of the people who lost their lives on 9/11? You know, I mean, it was always this, I feel like it was always a fine line. And I think that has eased up a little bit, but I think it's still there. You know, I think people are still trying to be very careful around the subject.
No one knew how to talk
storytellers.
No one knew how to talk about 9/11. Stand-up comedians didn't know how to talk about it. Storytellers, like news anchors, you know, like no one knew how to process this event.
Yes.
And for a long time afterwards. But you know, sorry, I'm full of rants today, but one more rant to end the episode, maybe. I think I told you, like, last winter, I, for some reason, started watching The West Wing for the first time ever. And I started watching it like right before last year's election, I think because I wanted to remember what a democracy looks like, because everything was so shit. And this was when we just didn't know whether Trump would get reelected or not. And so, loved West Wing first two seasons or whatever. I believe it was the very first episode of season three. Mm-hmm. It aired barely a month after 9/11. It was like October 2001 is when the very first episode aired. And I at first didn't understand what was happening in the episode. It was so not related to the season two finale. And it didn't feel like a continuation of the story at first, you know, and I was like, what the hell's going on? And then I realized, oh my God, Aaron Sorkin is trying to address the topic of 9/11 and terrorism in this stupid episode that aired not even a month after 9/11. Aman, I tell you, it was one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. It was one of the most condescending things I have ever seen. It was awful. I was genuinely so angry after I saw that episode. And it was like, it was the dumbest shit in the world. Basically, what happens in that episode is like, there's some like terror scare. Okay. And then one of the main characters, who's the chief of staff of the president, he basically tracks down the one and only Muslim guy who works in like the IT department of the White House and interrogates him for hours and hours and hours. Oh, and boy. And basically they find out, okay, he's just a really smart IT dude and he happens to be Muslim and brown. And then they let him go. And at the end of the episode, they show that poor guy back at his desk because he's like, well, I missed 7 hours of the workday. I have to literally catch up on my work now. And then the chief of staff walks by his desk and he's like, way to be back on the job. Like giving him like an approving nod of like, it was the worst thing ever. And I hated the fact that Aaron Sorkin thought he could somehow make sense of 9/11. Just mere weeks after it happened and put that shit on TV. It was just stupid. And I was like, you, like, no one else was trying to make sense of it or make TV about 9/11. Leave it alone. And I really think that whole episode should just be like burned off the face of the universe. Just terrible. Ugh. Anyway, that's my rant. And I don't know how much we've learned about 9/11 or what's going on in the last 20 years or what will happen in the next 20 years, but.
Well, I think at least our audience has learned a lot more about us.
Yes.
As individuals. And who was it that said, was it our dear friend Jason who said you wanted to learn more about us?
Yeah.
On our podcast?
Yes.
So shout out to Jason.
Shout out to you, Jason.
This was all for you, buddy. All for you.
Anyway, let us know what you think. And as always, thanks for listening to Grounded Geeks.
Catch you next time.